Lafayette, Lake Charles.
The following program is an encore presentation of The Exchange.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castillo. My guest in the studio today, Emily Broussard, is a student right here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And she, I should also say, KRVS's own Emily Broussard, because that's how Emily and I first met. She does work here in between classes and everything else that she's involved in here at the university. And she has had quite an interesting life and is still quite young. And we're going to talk about some of her travels that she has done out of the country and different natives from the different countries that she has been visiting and what she has learned about herself and what she has learned about those different cultures. So welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah, it's great to have you here. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up 30 minutes from here in a small town, St. Martinville.
Oh, you did? That's a beautiful historic town.
Yeah.
Huh?
I went to middle school there.
Yeah. Yep. And you're a senior here
I'm
at UL.
I'm a senior. Yes, ma'am.
And what are your studies focused on?
Well, I am studying psychology and anthropology, but I would like to go and get a PhD in African studies.
So, okay, let's back up. When you first decided to look at pursuing a degree with psychology, and but with anthropology especially, was your focus when you made that decision on African studies?
No, it wasn't. I started UL as a nursing student.
Ah, interesting.
For 2 years, I was a nursing student. I wanted to travel the world. It's kind of funny, but I actually wanted to be a little Mother Teresa. That's what I used to think of it as. And I thought nursing was my avenue to do exactly what Mother Teresa did. So that's what I started in.
Where does that come from? I mean, you know, was that through high school too?
Yeah, I went to Catholic school all my life.
Yeah.
I grew up in a Catholic family, and I really watched my parents, just how selfless they are and always caring about other people. And I always just thought that was really beautiful. Whenever people would ask me, you know, what do you want to do? And I never really had any other interests aside from just always wanting to be like Mother Teresa. I even considered being a nun at one time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Before I started college, I wanted to be a nun.
Yeah, to really go, that's really cool. And, you know, hats off to your folks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a great effect that they can have on, I mean, what better effect that you can have on a child than to pass on something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, are they involved in volunteer work, in mission work, or just their day-to-day lives?
Yeah, mostly just their day-to-day lives, really. I watched them grow spiritually as a child, just them getting stronger and stronger in their spirituality and their faith, and it just really inspired me. But my dad is involved in mission work. He came on my very first mission trip to Guatemala.
Oh, so very cool. How old were you, or how long ago was that when you went to Guatemala?
I was 17 years old. I was a junior in high school.
Yeah.
These two very nice Guatemalan ladies came to our school to talk about an exchange program, and they briefly mentioned volunteering in Guatemala for the summer. And I just immediately thought, wow, this is my shot. Like, this is what I've been wanting to do since people have been asking me, what do you want to do? I was a sophomore then, and my parents weren't really ready for me to leave the country, and at least not by myself.
Yeah.
So I waited a year. And then finally, it was with a mission group in Louisiana, a Catholic mission group. We went to the talk with the priest who heads the organization, and my dad was just It was just his thing. He just knew he wanted to come too. So we went together for the first time in the summer of 2009.
Yeah.
And he has gone ever since.
Well, now, when that trip was being planned, mm-hmm. or I would assume you were having meetings with whoever was organizing the group that was going, what were the types of things that were discussed, you know, that you would do when you went to Guatemala?
Well, because it was a faith-based group,
sure.
A lot of it, I just remember the word presence. So the priest talked a lot about how we would be present. Not necessarily we would be doing these, you know, hard labor tasks,
sure.
But we would be present with the people.
Okay.
So it wouldn't just be us helping people, but also the people helping us, either spiritually or just in any type of growth, any growth that you wanted as a
yeah.
human.
Mm-hmm. What are your memories from when you did that first trip? What really stood out for you? What did you bring back?
I think I always look at it as my eyes were opened for the first time. I wasn't born until I landed in Guatemala. I always had American eyes before, and then immediately, whenever I stepped foot on the soil in that village, that all just disappeared, and I became a fellow human.
But tell us what the village was like. What were the people like? What did it look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, the people of the village were Catholic. They were Mayan. Their ethnicity was Mayan, so they spoke Quechiquel.
Quechiquel.
Ah,
okay.
Mm-hmm. So even though I studied, you know, Spanish in high school, I wasn't prepared for the language barrier because I did not at all know Quechiquel. But there's this huge church in the center of the town, and then a school.
Was it a smaller village?
Yes, it was very small.
Okay.
And basically, there's just one road throughout. I was in the highlands, and there's just one straight road, and it just connects you to each village.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You just go up the mountains, down the mountains, all on that one road.
Yeah.
There's a center, a very small center, just with a church and maybe a community center, and then you go off into dirt paths, and that's where you find the homes of the community members.
And can describe the homes for us. What did they look like? Remember the material they were constructed from?
Yeah, a lot of it was tin, maybe different, like branches made from branches and tin, and dirt floors, and mostly one room, maybe two.
Yeah.
There was usually one big bed or maybe one bed, two beds, one for the parents and then one for the children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How were you received?
Very well. They were expecting us because the mission group goes often. They go almost every year.
Okay.
They'll switch locations, but they'll keep coming back to this particular village because that's where they started, in that particular village. So they're very welcoming. On every travel I've been to, every country I've been to, every indigenous area, they've always been extremely welcoming. Every time I come back from a different country, I say, wow, those are the nicest people I've ever met.
Isn't that fabulous?
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, were the people curious about you and the other folks that went with you? About how you live?
Yes.
How you do certain things?
Yes, definitely. A lot of them, it's different for each country, but mostly they all already have a perception.
Yeah, and what about, what are your memories from, specifically from Guatemala? Yeah.
Trying to remember.
Yeah.
So long ago, but yeah, they had a perception already of America. A lot of times I was playing with the children, playing soccer, football. And they would ask, some of them knew English, and they would ask just different things about America. Because I was hanging out with mostly just the children at that time. I didn't get very complex questions, like that later on would make me wonder,
yeah,
what is America? So at that time, I wasn't really asking myself questions about what is America at that time.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You were a different age than you are now.
I wasn't really cognizant of just the complexities of different societies and how they differ. That came much later.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you come back, and the next trip that you took, was that once you were in college?
Yes, that was in 2012.
Okay.
I was a nursing student at the time, and me and my friend, we were talking about how we wanted to do volunteer work as nursing students. And we were looking online at different volunteer organizations, and we saw one in Nepal. I had never heard of Nepal before. For those who don't know, it's a country between China and India. It's very much a hybrid of those two countries. So we were talking about it at a coffee shop, and then this man behind us said, Are you talking about Nepal? And we're like, yeah. He's like, oh, well, I live there now. Why don't I connect you?
That was here in Lafayette?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. He was traveling here doing some work, and he connected me. Unfortunately, my friend couldn't make it, but he connected me with a naturopathic student from Oregon who runs her own nonprofit there.
In Nepal?
In Nepal, in a village in Nepal.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you had... You called her up or you emailed? Or?
Yeah. We stayed in contact for about a year. My parents
wanted to have
a heart attack. Yes.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know her. I didn't know the people we were going with. I was very trustful at that time, at that age. I like to think I still am. My parents aren't always happy with that.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, so the first time I met her and her... The other naturopathic students who were there was in Nepal. They picked me up at the airport.
Very cool. So mm-hmm. how long were you there for?
I was there for about a month.
For a month. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which is, that's a nice period of time.
Yeah, that was the first time I had been away from home for that long, usually in Guatemala. I went twice to Guatemala before that, and I was there for a week. And then the next year I was there for 2 weeks.
Okay.
So this was different.
And so the organization that she was involved mm-hmm. with, now this was an organization she started?
Yes.
Okay.
An NGO that she started.
And what was their focus?
Her focus was on a particular village. She wanted to, once she graduated from naturopathic school, she wanted to move there to that particular village and basically be a doctor for them. Where the village is, there's multiple villages all around that area. We were basically in the Himalayan mountains.
Okay.
And
what time of year did you go?
I went in July.
And what was the weather like there at that time?
It was monsoon season, so basically it rains a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was rainy, but warm. Usually in the winter, since they're in the mountains, it snows a lot.
Yeah.
But we didn't have any snow or anything like that. I was wearing short sleeves.
Okay.
Shorts.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, Emily, how she first got connected to that village? What drew her mm-hmm. there? How did she even know that it existed, I guess?
Yeah. Well, so a lot of people I meet on my travels are people who are just so free-spirited and just... ready to explore and ready to just live in solidarity with others, to like just go one day and rely on others just to take care of them. Whatever they need, they're minimalist. They just take what they have on their back and they just go and meet people and really meet people.
Yeah.
And that's what she did. She was in Nepal before this trip.
It's really interesting how you just said that,
mm-hmm.
where you said they go and they meet people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really meet people.
Yeah.
For you, what's the difference between the way you said both of those lines? How do you really meet somebody What do you come away with?
I think it's all about reciprocity. So it's all about, I'm going to trust you. You are a stranger, but you're a human, and I'm going to trust you. And I hope that you can trust me. And we're just going to be present together.
Yeah.
Whatever happens in that moment, we're going to be together.
Yeah. And then go back to how she chose that specific village.
So she was just traveling through Nepal with the guy who I met in Lafayette who told me about the trip. They were on a bus in the mountains, just, they didn't know where they were going, and they just stopped. And she met the chief of the village, who I ended up staying with in his family home. And he told them, where are you staying tonight? He asked. And they were like, we don't know. And he said, well, we'll take care of you.
Very nice. You know, what's interesting, too, what you said earlier, Emily, about, you know, that the focus is that we're just going to be present.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going there to change anybody,
mm-hmm.
or to catch them up on what you think they should be caught up on,
yeah.
or live how you believe,
mm-hmm.
or anybody else believes they should live.
Yeah.
But just to be,
mm-hmm.
and to learn whatever you can at that moment.
Yeah.
About whatever that moment is about, huh?
Yeah. And that's what drove me to be a student of anthropology, actually. That fact. When I first went to Guatemala, I had the thought that these people need me. This 17-year-old. They need this 17-year-old. Yeah. And I know how to save them.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
But I didn't know what I was saving them from.
Yeah.
I just saw, you know, movies and things that depicted these poor people. They're not poor at all. They're just not American.
Yeah,
and they just don't have the materials of Americans, you know.
Uh-huh.
But that's not a value there. Materials are nothing.
Yeah. You noticed that same thing when you were in Nepal, too?
Yes, every country I've been to.
Okay.
Because I've always gone to indigenous areas. So I'm never in these, you know, big cities, these big westernized cities full of people. I'm with people who are connected to the land, and they've been connected to the land for years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to Nepal, and you're mm-hmm. going to be there for a month.
Yes.
And on that trip, was there any type of itinerary that was laid out for you, or any kind of a, you know, and schedule may show where I grew up, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, being Americanized.
Yeah.
Was there anything like that laid out for you?
It was relaxed. It was a relaxed trip. But our main goal was to set up a naturopathic camp.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we had one doctor with us, a naturopathic doctor. And we were going to see as many people as we could. Because if they needed to go to a hospital, they had to go to the capital. Kathmandu.
Okay.
And that is hours
away.
Hours away.
And how would they get there?
Bus. Public bus. Which are school buses here. That's
sure.
what they have. Mm-hmm. And it's very dangerous to travel there.
And so medicine that was practiced in their village, did they mm-hmm. have, you know, elders or, you know, other
yes.
folks who... Was it traditional medicine for them?
They do have traditional medicine called Ayurvedic medicine.
Ayurvedic?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And we actually had an Ayurvedic doctor with us.
Let me ask you, is that a term?
Ayurvedic?
Yeah.
Yes.
It doesn't stand for something that I just don't know.
No.
Yeah,
no,
that's
no.
a term from there. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right.
It's their traditional medicine.
Okay.
And we also had a Nepalese doctor who practices Western medicine.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Surprisingly, most people, it wasn't surprising to me at all. Most people wanted to go to the Western doctor.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Just because of that perception of
what do you think the perception
what Western
was?
Medicine does. The Western doctor had prescription drugs. We didn't.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess.
Somewhere they had learned that somehow that's supposed to fix
yeah,
something.
And the fact that they never have it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
You were able to spend time with the individual there who practiced the traditional medicine?
I didn't spend much time with him. He was only there one day.
Okay.
But I did spend a lot of time with the naturopathic doctor from Oregon. One reason she wanted to come to Nepal was because naturopathics is connected to Eastern medicine. So yeah. Mm-hmm, she wanted to, you know, go to its birthplace, basically.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so what she did, she was a chiropractor, so she would, you know, crack bones and readjust, realign. It's all about balancing the body.
And with the nervous system, too, chiropractic care. I mean, really focuses on,
yeah,
on the nervous system,
yeah,
and how that affects.
Mm-hmm. And all the remedies we gave were herbal.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And all of the herbs came from Nepal. If they weren't picked ourselves in the village, we purchased them in Nepal.
So that's the only time you've been there?
In Nepal, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, okay. So on that trip, I'm assuming, mm-hmm, that you had to learn what you were doing and what the group was doing with the natural herbs from
yes,
the naturopath that came,
mm-hmm,
with you from Oregon?
Yes, definitely. I was basically the nurse there. So,
okay.
Yeah, I would, whatever the doctor would say, I learned, you know, how much of this herb to give them. Do I put it in a tea or I do it with this? Do I do it with that? Yeah.
So tell me about what a day was like there during that time. What would a day, and I don't know that there was a typical, mm-hmm, day.
There wasn't a typical day. I just remember we would maybe tour the village, meet a new.
And what did
family.
That mean, tour the village? Like, actually, was somebody taking you around, or were,
yes,
you just explore? Okay.
We were with, since we were living with the chief of the village,
okay,
he wanted to show us everywhere. And just like in Guatemala, there wasn't even a main square in this village, but there's a main dirt road, and then small little bitty roads that you have to climb over rocks and go through the water and just to get to the next house. That's something that's extremely different than from here, because we're used to flat land.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But it would take us maybe 30 minutes to get to the next house. Or.
And was travel how?
So once we were in the village, it was just on foot.
On foot, okay.
Mm-hmm. But if we were traveling back to the capital, we would have a rental vehicle, but we couldn't drive it because the roads are so dangerous.
Sure.
There's always landslides in the mountains and things like that. So we would hire a driver. And then if we were in the city, in the capital, we'd take rickshaws.
Yeah, you would. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in the village that you were in Nepal, can you describe what that village looked like? What the houses looked like? What the buildings were?
Yeah. I remember the different art in the village. Like I said, Nepal's a hybrid. So the village itself was a hybrid between half of them, or roughly half, were Hindu and then half were Buddhist. So you would just see this, you'd go into one house and there were Hindu gods, pictures of Hindu gods, and then you go into the next house and you'd see Buddha. But everything was very colorful. Very, very colorful. Mm-hmm. And they'd use
like bold colors?
Bold colors,
yeah.
Like yellows and oranges and reds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
Yeah.
The folks that you met while you were there,
mm-hmm,
were there some that really stood out for you, that you have great memories of who they were as people, as human beings?
Yeah. Just the family I stayed with, the chief and his wife. They're basically farmers. They eat what they grow, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
They might have a goat or a cow, and, you know, if that cow dies or that goat dies, it's hard on them.
Yeah.
So.
Was there a central marketplace in the village?
No.
So did everybody kind of fend for themselves in,
yes,
terms of their food?
Mm-hmm.
And
everyone. had their own gardens, and then they would have larger areas where they farmed, like corn and things like that. I remember the grandmother, well, the mother of the chief, we called her Ama, which means grandmother. She was very old, and every morning, whenever we were just waking up, she'd come back with a huge bag of corn on her back that she had been picking for hours. And I couldn't even do that. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, every day, every single day. And she never spoke. She was just always working, shucking corn, picking corn all the time.
How did you communicate with the people there?
The chief actually was a teacher in the village school. He taught English, and his brothers spoke English. Okay. So it was relatively easy to communicate with the men. The women, however, they would have to translate for the women.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But did you find ways or techniques that you were able, if you didn't have an interpreter there?
Yeah. Whenever I was cooking with the mother, with the chief's wife, you know, we would point at things and she'd tell me the Nepalese word for it. And then I'd tell her the English word and stuff like that. And yeah, we did a lot of signing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious on that trip. What did the people teach you? What did you bring back?
Oh, man. I'm going to have to think about this one. It was a combination of both the people, the villagers, and the naturopathic students. They taught me that my place on this earth, I think, is to be a voice for people who aren't in the Western world.
Okay.
For people who are, quote, in third worlds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did anybody, do you remember, recall on that trip, did anybody ask you why you were there? Why did you come? Why did you travel to our village? I'm just curious if that question ever came up.
It's a little hard for me to remember.
Yeah.
But I do remember, because at that time, like I said, I grew up from Guatemala. I was no more. The moment I left Guatemala, I knew that I wasn't going to travel anymore to save people or protect people or me do something to people. I was going to learn from people because I felt like I had more to learn from them than they had to learn from me.
Yeah.
And so I think that that would have been the response I would have given them. And a lot of times they were shocked.
It shocked about?
Like, what could an American learn from me?
Ah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk about, because you've also spent quite a bit of time, I mean, just recently in Ghana.
Yes, this summer I was in Ghana for 2 months.
And where your studies are taking you. And we're going to hear right now a song that is from Ghana, actually. And this is from a CD put out by Nonsuch. But we're going to listen to a song that's called the Dagumbo Song.
Thank you.
All right, that was the Dagumbo song, and that's taken from Nonesuch Records, their Africa series, and the focus on Ghana, and the name of it is Ancient Ceremonies, Dance, Music, and Songs. And if you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM, or you can catch us on the web, too, at krvs.org. Always check out the website to check out the podcast, and we do have over 30 locally produced programs. And we do have our fundraiser in the month of October, and want to say thanks to everyone who all year long continues to support the station. You can do it very easily, just going to the website at krvs.org, and there's the red donate button, and it helps us continue to do these programs as well as all of the national programs that we bring into this station. My guest in the studio today, Emily Broussard of KRVS here. She is a student worker here, but is a student here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, majoring in psychology and anthropology. And we've been talking about some of the trips she took at a younger age when she went to Guatemala and to Nepal. And your studies and your life kind of took a more focused direction on another area of
yes.
our world, and that's in Africa.
Yes.
And how did that come about, Emily? That became a focus for you now in your studies.
Mm-hmm. It was a long journey, a journey that I didn't really notice at first. So once I decided that nursing wasn't really the right thing, the right path for me, after Nepal, I knew that I wanted to become an anthropologist. I was just too fearful at first to go down that route.
Okay, because what was the scary part for you?
I didn't know my options. I didn't know of any practical jobs I could have as an anthropologist. But later I realized that my passion really is doing research and documenting people's lives.
Interesting.
Yeah, so really, my focus in African studies began, this is really like an intimate thing for me. Growing up in St. Martinville, there's a huge divide between races.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And as a young white woman, I started seeing things differently whenever I started working at the city pool in St. Martinville.
Sure.
At a young age, I was probably 14 years old.
Yeah.
And most of the guests at our pool are young African-American children, and that was the first time I was ever really close to anyone who was African-American.
Interesting.
The first time. Looking at it now, it boggles me. You know, coming to the university now where it's so diverse.
Sure.
Like, I can't even imagine. I was 14 years old whenever I came in contact with people of a different skin color.
And St. Martinville isn't that large of a community.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that just showed how sheltered I was and from what.
Like, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And why was I sheltered from it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just fell in love with the people who society said was different from me. Culturally, yes, they were different from me. And I was just, why was I away from them for so long?
Yeah.
From another human. So that's kind of where it started. And then at the university, that was the first time I met an African. And I was just blown away. I've always been blown away by people who are different from me.
Sure.
Culturally, specifically. And I was just blown away. They probably thought I was the weirdest person because I was just staring at them. Like, I would listen to them speak. I was just amazed. Amazed. And I just fell in love with the people. I started meeting a lot of African friends at the university. And just the fact that they were so different from me, but so much the same. They were just like me, but society said that they were so different.
Sure.
And they weren't.
Yeah.
At all. You know? And I think just that
a nice
fact,
thing for you to find out.
Yeah.
That was an important discovery for you.
Mm-hmm. And it just made me look at the world a lot differently.
Yeah.
You know? A different perspective. And why is it that I grew up that way? And why did I have to learn on my own?
Mm-hmm.
That people are people no matter what.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The trip that you took this summer when you went to Ghana,
mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
I went to a conference, a local conference, last October, which was held in St. Martinville and Parks area. It was an African symposium. So, mm-hmm.
Wait, was that with Dr. Muhammad?
Yes.
Oh, very cool.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay.
So, African professors came and basically they came to see the African diaspora in St. Martinville and in Parks. And I jumped on that. I wanted to volunteer and make connections.
This with the Promise Land project.
Mm-hmm.
That
yes.
They have
so, we
going
went
on
to
there.
Promise Land.
Fabulous.
Yes.
You know, Dr. Muhammad was on the show
mm-hmm.
about a year and a half ago or so, something like that, when he first. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. So I went with Dr. Brasseur, who's one of my professors and mentors.
Yeah, that is. We'll give a tip of the hat to Dr.
Yeah.
Ray. Yeah, we certainly will.
So, yeah, he told me about it, and I went, and I made a connection with Dr. Aubrey. She's originally from Parks, from mm-hmm. Promised Land. And she now teaches at Arizona State University.
Oh, okay.
She's she's a political science and African studies professor. She does research in Cameroon, which is in Central Africa. And she told me about an organization called Operations Crossroads Africa.
Hmm.
Yes. Based in New York City. It's a nonprofit that connects Americans and, people from all over the world, really, but mostly Americans. To NGOs in Africa, in African countries.
Hmm.
And then you work as a volunteer for that NGO for 2 months.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So basically I told them my interests. At the time I wanted to work with women and women's empowerment and education. So they connected me along with 9 other wonderful women. From all over the states.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was the only one from the deep south. most of them were from the northeast and one from Canada. And just us 10 women, we went to Ghana together to the Volta region in the east.
So what was proposed to you or planned out for you that you would be doing while you
mm-hmm.
were there?
So, I knew that I was going to a small village again called Atabu.
And that's where you really learn what life is about, right?
Yes.
In those small villages.
That's really my paradise on earth, small villages.
Yeah, yeah.
Really. It's hard to adjust back, actually, whenever I come back. Adjust to the big city of Lafayette.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So, I knew I was going to Atabu in the Volta region. I knew that I was going to be working with Hope for Future Generations, which...
That's the name of an organization?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, that empowers women and children, basically. I was going to work in junior high schools and senior high schools with teenage girls on teaching them about reproductive health and feminine hygiene.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then I was also working a little bit with starting a bakery in the village so that the women could have some kind of income.
Oh, fabulous. Mm-hmm. Were you able to add or bring out some of your own ideas to the projects, or did you have a pretty tight schedule or plan that you had to follow?
No, it was, we came up with a lot of the curriculum.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause we also did a seminar with Healthy Relationships. We basically just had the girls, we just sat them down in a circle, and instead of lecturing them like we had been doing, we just wanted an open conversation about what is a healthy relationship for you as a teenage female.
And how was the communication for you at that time?
Mm-hmm. Well, so English is the official language.
It is, right?
Okay. Of Ghana. Yes. So some of the older adults spoke just Ewe, which is the local language.
Ewe, okay.
But most of the children spoke English. They teach English in the schools.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the children, were they bilingual? Did they also speak their native language too? Very nice.
In Ghana, most people are trilingual or, you know, speak four languages. There's so many.
Which is in so many countries.
Yeah. There's so many local languages.
Can you describe what that village looked like?
Yes. So it was a lot bigger than the other villages I had been to. The CEO of the nonprofit that we were working with, this was the village that she grew up in. And they had these big cement houses for volunteers to live in. You learn that whenever you go to Ghana right away, that the locals are going to treat you better as a foreigner than they will other locals. Mm. So you get priority treatment.
Was that uncomfortable at all for you?
Very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I would think so.
Very uncomfortable. That's just what they do, though.
Yeah.
It's important to them to show who Ghanaians really are. Like I said, they're the nicest people in the world, and they want to show that. Very proud. Yeah. Extremely proud. We'll give you the shirt off their back. We'll make sure you have food in your belly.
And so that village that you were in, how did they obtain food there?
So in this village, about a mile or so away, they had a small city or township called Hohoi, and they have a huge market in Hohoi. Either women, mostly the men worked in the farms or in construction, so the women would sell different items. Everything's fresh there.
Okay.
There's really no anything that's with preservatives or anything like that. Yeah. I think the only thing I saw like that was tomato paste in a can, and that's it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, Emily, with some of the direction that the programs you were involved in were taking and some of their mission in terms of empowering the women, how was that received by the men there?
Most of them were extremely excited about it.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Very excited about it. Although you do see that women don't necessarily have the same privileges as men, just like almost anywhere else, there's a huge respect for women in Ghana. And anyone would tell you that Africa is the motherland, not the fatherland. Without a mother, a Ghanaian wouldn't be born. They would tell you that. So although they did have different roles than the men, they were definitely supportive for the women to be empowered and to do whatever to make them happy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was part of the empowerment, you know, you talked about one of the project was starting a bakery.
Mm-hmm.
So was it teaching, I'm taking from that then, was teaching the women business skills?
Yes.
Learning about finance, was that?
A little. Not all of our projects worked out, and that's something I've always learned in my travels. Mm-hmm. This is not America. It is not going to happen in a day. It's not going to happen in 2 days or 3 days. It's going to take a while. So with the bakery, it was mostly the women teaching us. Sometimes I was a little confused. Like, sure. What am I volunteering for women to teach me how to bake and stuff?
Yeah, but
like
you
that.
Know, but look at that whole empowering aspect of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for someone to be able to teach
mm-hmm.
and to educate about a way of life
yeah.
that they know their path. That's a real empowering moment for people.
Definitely,
to
most
be able to
definitely.
Teach.
And I was fine with it because I was doing my own personal research there.
Yeah,
I was there to volunteer, but I was also there to figure out what it is that I wanted to study. I was there to document as much as I could.
Yeah.
So I was really happy about that. And I knew from my past experiences that, like I said, I won't always be satisfied with my volunteer work because it's not going to go as I want it to. I'm not going to see a huge change as a volunteer being there for only 2 months. But I think it might have been difficult for the other females who came with me, the Americans, who haven't been outside before of the States. That was a little difficult, I think, for them.
You think there was some frustration in,
yes.
like, the time frame? Things aren't happening
definitely.
As quickly as we think they should?
Yeah, we were on African time, which means we'll go to this school at 8 o'clock. That means we will go to the school at noon.
Yeah.
That's what it means. There was a wedding in our village supposed to start, I think, at like 11 o'clock, it began at 3 o'clock.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
a different concept of time.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I'm very comfortable with it. I would prefer that.
Yeah.
If we had that here.
And I think, too, you know, it's that whole piece of learning that the way that we think about things, that's not the right way.
Right. Exactly.
You know.
Whenever we would make comments about the time and stuff, they're like, what's the hurry? Like
exactly.
I don't understand why time is so important. It's important that, yeah, we get it done, you know?
Yeah.
But why rush it? Why rush things?
And what do people miss out on, really,
yeah.
in life, in the rushing?
Yeah. They may set a time, but that's not their focus. Their
yeah.
focus is actually on the work that they're trying to get done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which some of that work may be what?
Well, it could be anything, like any celebration.
Taking care of a family member.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the real yeah. day-to-day stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the difference. I never really, whenever people would, like, come home from work, and it wasn't work like, oh, I was in an office all day. No, I was in the farm, or I was in the market selling all day, selling my items.
Yeah.
That's what you did. And whenever you get home, there's no talk about that. It's really about being present, kind of like I said before.
And, you know, that's an interesting point, Emily, because what, you know, conversations that I have had with a lot of people and listening to a lot of conversations have been, and this isn't just here in this area, but people's frustrations over, as Americans, we tend to focus on an individual and what do you do for work?
Yes.
And then that's what you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, what do you do? Just like, what do you do for fun?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, did you hear that music last night? Or how was it gardening today? I mean, you know, that doesn't come out as often as when
yeah.
you first meet somebody. Like, what do you do for work?
Yeah.
You know? What do
yeah.
you do?
Mm-hmm. Mostly it would be about, they'd ask me about my family.
Yeah.
Even now, I'm still in contact with a lot of my Ghanaian friends and African friends who I met in Ghana. And always, not a day goes by. How's your family? Are they well?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, like, in Ghana, the healthcare is not like an American healthcare. And a lot of times they do rely on naturopathics,
mm-hmm.
just like in Nepal. And that's one thing I take back the uncertainty. In Ghana, the people I met, there was this acceptance of uncertainty. They would make, before I would leave, maybe if I'd be visiting a friend, they would say comments like, I hope I see you tomorrow. Like, I hope you're well tomorrow and I'm going to see you tomorrow. I made a plan with one of my friends from Uganda that I was going to go there and visit him next summer. And he's like, oh, I hope you're alive and well next summer for you to come and see me. There's just this uncertainty that you may not be there tomorrow.
Sure, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a beauty in it to live in the moment.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Part of your living in the moment there, too, just as the song that we had played, is you did get to experience some of the music and the dance from that area.
Yes.
What stood out for you about the music and the dance, mm-hmm. specifically?
Well, a lot of the dancing I did was in local nightclubs, which are very different from here. There, you go there to dance.
Okay.
You don't go there necessarily to drink or mingle with the opposite sex. You go there to dance, and that's what you're doing. And that was something completely new for me.
And what were the buildings like? Like the nightclubs, what were those buildings like?
They weren't extravagant like in the United States. Some of them were just like huts,
sure.
and you danced outside.
Ah,
but
okay.
They always had music, like a huge stereo. You knew where the priorities were. It was in the music. You had good music all the time. You may not have had a roof over your head, and that was fine. You can dance under the stars.
Isn't that fabulous?
Mm-hmm.
So you go to the club. Was there any kind of money exchange, or was it just the gathering of people, like to get into the club? Did you
depended. If I was in the capital in Accra, then yes, you would have to pay, but not in the village. Mm-mm. Yeah.
And what stood out for you about the style of dance?
There was no thought about it. You just moved your body, and you moved all of your body. I think, at least with the people who I've gone to clubs with here, is very like, oh, I'm embarrassed. Like,
sure, yeah, yeah.
No, this was second nature, like no shame. And you're going to express yourself through moving your entire body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And were you able to join in?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's something I was very proud of myself for, because in high school, my friends would always tease me because they said I couldn't dance. And that really stuck with me.
Sure, it does.
You know, it was painful. And then I took a classical dancing class here at UL, and I realized I can move, you know? So once I got there.
And isn't that what dancing's about?
Yes.
Just moving.
Yeah. And just knowing the rhythm, like feeling the rhythm and not thinking.
Yeah.
It's about not thinking. It's about being on the same wavelength with the rhythm.
And isn't that goes back to one of the very first things you talked about in that theme that has gone throughout this hour, is that whole thing about just being present.
Yeah, that's all it was.
Yeah.
All your worries fly out of that hut that you're in dancing in, you know?
That's right.
You're one with the stars for that night.
Well, Emily, your professional life in terms of your studies, where does that take you now?
Well, once I graduate, I hope to go back to a West African country. And for a while, I want to just explore. I want to apprentice, maybe someone who does a craft there, maybe get good at dressmaking. There's beautiful dresses they make. Just something like that. And then I hope to come back and go to a PhD program in African studies.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Emily Broussard, it has been a thrill having you on today.
Thank you.
It's nice to touch base with the young folks and the students here at the university. And it gives me a real sense of just pride. I'm like just so taken by who you are as a human being. And our world is looking pretty good with having folks like you in there.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, it's very cool to hear what you're doing. And again, our guest has been Emily Broussard, who does work here at KRVS and is a student. Everybody, we are going to go out with a song called Zeal Duet, and the Zeal is like a xylophone, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And this, again, is from the Nonesuch CD. Everyone, have a good week.
Hi, this is Dan Phillips. Come on and funkify your life with my weekly mix of vintage and contemporary funk and rare groove music from New Orleans, elsewhere around the Gulf Coast and beyond. Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Friday nights at 9, Funkify Your Life on KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and online at krvs.org.